Okay. I think I just wanted to mention, I think we're pretty much well along on here. I'm going to skip through here. I just wanted to mention, refer you to this one paper that Annette Molinaro and Ruth Pfeiffer and I did to try to look at cross-validation, different variants of cross-validation and bootstrap resampling in terms of which method works well. There's a lot of criticism of cross-validation in the saying, well, it has too high a variance and other versions of cross-validation are better. And it really depends on how many cases you have. If you have a very small number of cases, then leave one out, cross-validation is actually the best thing to do. If you have a larger number of cases, like 40, then tenfold cross-validation can be somewhat better. But actually, the things like cross-validation, leave one out, or tenfold cross-validation are actually much better than a split sample method in terms of efficiency, in terms of actually accuracy of estimating the predictive accuracy of the model developed on your full data set. And that's because if you have a model developed on a full data set, say of 40 cases, that will have a certain predictive accuracy. Now, if you use split sample method, you're developing a model based on 20 cases, and you're estimating something based on the other 20 cases, but you're trying to estimate the model, the predictive accuracy of the model based on the full data set. So in doing it, you're using a model based on only half of the data set. So you actually get a biased estimate of the predictive accuracy. Your bias is, your predictive accuracy is actually better than what you're going to estimate. So leave one out, or tenfold cross validation, or the 0.632 bootstrap resampling, all of which are in BRBOA tools, are actually better than split sample method. This split sample method still has the advantage of it still has the advantage that you can bring biological insight into the, you don't have to have an algorithmic process for selecting your model. But if you do have an algorithm for model selection, cross-validation is actually better than the split sample method. Some journals somehow, they don't understand, or the reviewers don't understand, or the editors don't understand cross-validation, so they like to see a split sample validation rather than cross-validation. But really, cross-validation gives you a better estimate. I won't go through the details of the comparison, but we did it both with simulated data and with a couple of actual data sets. All of these methods, though, are what I would think of as internal methods of classifier validation. So, you know, if you really are going to use these classifiers in the future, there are other sources of variation that are probably not reflected in the cases, in the expression profiles that you have, such as variability over time and expression profiling and tissue handling and things like that. The common problems, the most common problems, the one we've mentioned many times, the pre-selection of genes using the entire data set. Another issue that's sometimes a problem is failure to consider optimization of tuning parameters as being part of a classification algorithm, or also erroneous use of predicted class in a regression model. I think I'll skip over the details here. As I've said before, if you have some kind of a tuning parameter, like the shrinkage thing in shrunken centroids, that really, the selection of that really should be considered part of the algorithm development process, and and that selection should itself be embedded in the cross-validation. Then there are issues of, does an expression, really, if you're talking about how well do things predict, you may want to compare it to how well it can predict using standard prognostic variables. And these, but the thing to bear in mind is, it's how well can the classifier predict, not what variables are statistically significant after you adjust for other variables. And so the focus should sort of remain on predictive accuracy. But the way you can do it is sort of, one of two ways is one to just sort of develop a gene expression-based classifier with either with cross-validation or a split sample, and then develop and get an estimate of prediction accuracy and do the same thing for using your standard clinical variables and just compare the predictive accuracy estimates. Or you can develop expression profile classifiers within subsets determined by the standard clinical variables. One problem that is sometimes made is to fit like a model to data containing standard covariates and the cross-validated predictions of the expression profile classifiers. Like, here's an example in which we might have a clinical variable Z, and then we might have a prediction based on the expression profile of case I, in which that prediction was sort of a leave one out cross-validation prediction, a prediction of the class of case I. And it looks like it should be okay because that prediction was made from a leave one out cross-validation. And several prominent papers have sort of then looked at these sort of multivariate sort of models and tried to assess which is more important, the clinical variable Z or this gene expression-based predictor Y. But the problem is, there's a statistical problem here, and that is that these Y values are not really independent because the cross-validated training sets have so much overlap. So the real multivariate logistic analysis is not really valid. It's a valid okay with split sample analysis because you don't have that dependence, but not with leave one out cross-validation. I'm not really going to get too much into external validation, except that there are other sources of variation that are not reflected either in split sample validation or in cross-validation. I did want to mention something about survival risk group prediction. And I'm not so much concerned about describing, I guess, the particular method we're using, but just what the idea of it is. Because when we talk about class prediction, we're really predicting a class of a case. With survival, we're not really going to try to predict the actual survival time of a case, because it's probably very difficult to predict that. But we've taken a position within BRBRA tools, and basically what we've implemented is essentially the supervised principal component method of Tibshirani. We say, really, what we would like to come up with at the end is a risk group, a risk grouping in which if you specify an expression profile, we'll wind up saying it's either relatively good prognosis, it's either risk group low or risk group high. Or you can specify, I want three risk groups, low, high, and intermediate. And so the objective is to sort of come up with some kind of a function which translates expression profile into risk group, but to do it in a way that does not force you to take your individual patient data and say this patient had long survival or short survival. In other words, we don't want to have to distort our data into categorizing it into long versus short or things like that, because the data may contain a lot of censoring and it may not really be feasible to do it. So there's a lot of publications now in the biomedical literature about analysis of survival, but they mostly distort the things by first categorizing their data into long or short. Well, if you're talking about diffuse large cell lymphoma, where basically the patients who are alive at 3 years are pretty much cured and the patients who die pretty quickly, that might not be much of a distortion, but if you have adequate follow-up. But usually it'll be more of a distortion. So here we're talking about a way of analyzing the data so that you don't have to distort the data. You can actually analyze the censored data, but you wind up predicting high risk or low risk of recurrence, or say of survival. And so the way we've actually done it, again, I say it, this is essentially the supervised principal component method of Tib Shirani, is we evaluate the individual genes by fitting single variable proportional hazard regression models to the log signals or log ratios. And we select genes based on some kind of a pre-specified p-value threshold from these single gene proportional hazard models. Just like what we do with the find the genes correlated with survival tool. But for these selected genes, we would then look at the linear combinations of the expression levels for these genes corresponding to the first K principal components, which should try to represent the main contributions of those genes. Now, normally principal components may not be related to your outcome, but here we're only doing principal components of genes selected as being related to survival or whatever your outcome is. And so you get these first three K principal components, where K is either maybe 1, 2, or 3, small number of principal components of potentially a large number of genes. And of course, you're going to do this within each training set. And then you fit a proportional hazard regression model, a multi-variable proportional hazard regression model with these K principal components, all K of them, as predictors. And let B1 through BK denote the estimated regression coefficients for those principal components. And then to predict for a case, say a case that was left out from that training set, what you do is you compute the K supervised principal components for that case, and you calculate this predictive index, which is a linear combination of these regression coefficients, which you got in your training set, times these principal components for the case that was left out. And so now, to embed it in a leave one out cross-validation, you create a training set by omitting the ith case. You developed a supervised principal component proportional hazards model for this training set, and you compute cross-validated predictive indices for the ith case, that is the one you left out, using this proportional hazard model developed for its training set, and you compute its predictive risk percentile of the predictive index for the ith case among the predictive indices for the cases that were actually in the training set. So in other words, you actually, in addition calculating this predictive index for the one left out, you calculate it using the cases that were actually used to build the model. And then you, I'm sorry, I guess I've missed a slide here. Okay. And then for the one that was left out, you say, well, for example, if you're trying to just get a low risk and a high risk group, you say, is its predictive index above the median predictive indexes for the cases in the training set? If it is, you predict that it's a poor risk case. And if its predictive index is below the median for the cases that were in that training set, you predict that it's a good risk case. And so that's the way of actually, for this case you've left out, of getting a prediction. Is it good risk or is it poor? Is that case good risk or is that case poor risk? And doing it in a way that the model building process doesn't use that case left out at all. And then at the end, you take the cases that were predicted to be good risk and you calculate a Kaplan-Meier curve, survival curve for them. And you take the cases that were predicted to be poor risk and you calculate the Kaplan-Meier case curve for them. And you can actually then display those Kaplan-Meier curves. And sort of the spread between those curves represents the degree to which your expression-based modeling can predict survival risk. Now, there is then an additional complication if you want to calculate a p-value for that difference in those Kaplan-Meier curves. You can actually easily compute a log rank statistic comparing those two Kaplan-Meier curves. The only thing is you can't use the usual statistical significance test associated with a log rank test because the assignment of cases to low risk or high risk are not independent, because they're made based on these overlapping training sets. And so in order to get a statistical significance associated with this log rank test, we permute the survival data, the survival times and corresponding censoring indicators among all of the, randomly permuted among all of the expression profiles, and repeat that entire process. And then for each randomly permuted set of survival times, we get two new predicted, predicted good risk group and a predicted poor risk group, and a value of the log rank statistic. And in that way, we generate the permutation distribution, the null permutation distribution of the log rank statistic. And from that null permutation distribution, we look at the value of the log rank statistic that we got for our real data and where does it fall in the tail of that null distribution. And that's how we get a p-value. A lot of computation. That's all handled by BRBOA tools. Some of this stuff was not part of Tib Shirani's proposal, but the supervised principal component idea was his. There are other approaches to survival risk group prediction that have been published, and this is the method I included this method at this point because it sort of generalizes very well to comparing it to developing models using clinical covariates and comparing them, and to developing models using a combination of clinical covariates and expression variables, which BRBOA tools also does. I won't really go through the details of how that's done. This was just a summary. I think I'll show you. This is just a summary of things we've already gone over. Some other things, I guess, in BRBOA tools. As I mentioned before, there's this plug-in facility, and we've included some of the some tools. It's easy for us to, particularly if we have R functions for them, it's easy to write a plugin and incorporate it into BRB array tools. And we have a real nice facility for if someone writes a plugin as an R function, our software automatically generates a user interface for that their plugin that prompts the user for any input variables, and that then launches their plugin. And so we've tried to make it easy for statisticians to write plugins to be incorporated into BRB array tools without having to know anything about how to program these user dialogues. R does not have a facility for dialog box sort of data input of parameters. And so we've programmed an automatic dialog box generator is part of BRB array tools. And when you develop a plugin, it will generate such a dialog for you. We have a couple of analysis of variance modules, which I won't go through, including a time series analysis module. The random forest and the top scoring pair, I think, are implemented as plugins. The advantage of plugins is it's very quick to develop plugins, particularly if you already have R functions for them. The disadvantage of them is that they are then in R, and R is not nearly as computationally efficient as Fortran is, in which we program most of our really computationally heavy analyses. As I mentioned before, cluster analysis is frequently used in cases where by clustering selected genes and for class prediction as well as for class comparison, cluster analysis isn't the appropriate approach. We can just show here the survival risk group prediction, and basically it wants to know survival status code, survival, and then it asks you, well, how many principal components to use in these supervised principal components, and then it asks you about clinical covariates. Are there any clinical covariates that you want to include? And if you say yes, it will ask you, well, what column of your experiment descriptor form has the clinical covariates? And it allows up to 3 clinical covariates, and it'll give you models that have expression variables only, models that have clinical covariates only, and it'll give you models that have combination of expression variables and clinical variables, with the expression variables selected as those genes that seem to be significant over and above the relation of the clinical variables to survival. And it will give you sort of a cross-validated Kaplan-Meier curves for all 3 of those kinds of models. I think I will not take the time to, I don't know what we have on the option page, to do that since we are running short on time. And it asks you with risk groups, do you want 2 risk groups or do you want 3 risk groups? And do you want to sort of divide things based on a 50th percentile or something else? And do you want to use leave one out cross-validation or tenfold cross-validation? And when do you want to actually go through this whole thing of getting a p-value for your cross-validated Kaplan-Meier curves? That will add a lot of time to it. I guess one last thing I want to demonstrate. Well, actually, I guess we'll demonstrate it when we get to the last portion here, which will be the class discovery. I usually don't have a whole lot to say about class discovery in the sense that, well, for two reasons. One, it's often used inappropriately, and secondly, because it's just a very exploratory set of methods, and there aren't really good rules of thumb, you know, should you use, should you center your genes, should you standardize your genes, should you use complete linkage or partial, you know, or average linkage. There's a lot of various clustering methods, and there's a lot of options on using even standard hierarchical clustering, and there aren't really good answers to questions of, well, which should I use? In other words, because there's no real gold standard way of finding out, well, what... there have been some studies, I guess, that have tried to generate data from statistical models and then to cluster the data with various different algorithms to see which algorithms best recover the true clusters that were inherent in the data. Not enough of those kinds of studies, but outside of those kind of studies, it's very hard to know which methods are better. The idea of clustering is really to try to discover subsets of disease, if we're talking about clustering samples, that represent distinctions that we might not have known existed. And so it's actually a very important objective. It's just we don't have real good guidelines for how to go about doing it. Basically, clustering depends on some kind of a distance or similarity metric to do the clustering, and what genes are you going to use in the cluster analysis? All of the genes, or the genes that seem to have some sort of degree of variable expression across your set of samples, and then there's a whole raft of clustering algorithms. Usually the clustering is performed on log ratios, if you have two channel arrays, or log signals, if you have gene chips. And I thought I will just go through the basics of hierarchical clustering so that you can understand that. And the idea is you start off with a situation where you think of each sample as its own sample. And then you say, of these, are there any... which two samples are the most similar with regard to all the genes, or all the genes I'm using in this cluster analysis? And you have some measure of similarity, usually either correlation or a distance, which is sort of the reverse of similarity. And you measure you merge the two samples that are closest together or most similar with regard to your similarity or distance metric. And you say, well, okay, this is a mini cluster. And then what you do is you say, okay, this mini cluster, I'm gonna replace, okay, so I've got a mini cluster and now I've got all of the other individual samples. And now I'm gonna continue this process. I'm gonna say, well, either which other pair of samples are most similar, or which is there some sample which is very similar to this mini cluster I've already created? And then you need some sort of a definition of what do you mean by similarity of a sample to a mini cluster. And There's a couple of ways of defining that. But there's a thing called average linkage, meaning where you measure the similarity of the sample to each element of that mini cluster, and then you average those similarities. Or complete linkage, meaning you measure similarity by you measure similarity of this sample to all of the elements of this mini cluster, and you take the lowest value of similarity. So you're trying to only merge something in there if it's similar to all of them in that mini cluster. Or there's a thing called single linkage, which is usually not recommended, where you say, okay, the similarity of a sample to a mini cluster is the largest. You calculate it for each element of the mini cluster, and then you take the largest value of similarity. So you're going to tend to merge it in there if that other sample is close to any of the elements of that mini cluster. And then so you do these pairwise mergings and building up a see if we have a picture. Yeah, picture here showing you started off by these two. So each thing here represents an individual sample numbered 1 through 31. This is Mike Bittner's melanoma data. And turns out that sample 12 and 13 were the ones that were closest together. And so they were sort of merged into a mini cluster, sort of, and that was just sort of graphically represented in that way. And and then the next thing that happened looks like is probably that these two samples, 19 and 20, were merged together. And then the next thing that happened is that this sample 11 was merged in with this mini cluster. And the level at which these things are placed in this diagram called a dendrogram is, this is sort of the degree of, this axis gives sort of the degree of similarity of the two things that went into that mini cluster. So actually, I guess it's, in this case, it's not similarity, it's probably distance, maybe some measure of Euclidean distance. No, distance is 1 minus correlation. So the correlation between these two expression profiles was about 80%. But then when this got merged into the mini cluster, the level of similarity was 1 minus 25%, so what, 75%. And this is average linkage, so it was sort of based on the average similarity between this thing and that one, and this thing and that one. And now you have a mini cluster consisting of three samples. And anyway, so things, at each step you say, well, what two things are most similar? Either two samples, or a sample in some mini cluster, or two mini clusters themselves. And if you're talking about merging of mini clusters as sort of what happens here, you've got one cluster consisting of these two samples, and now you've got another cluster consisting of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 samples, and they actually get merged at that point. And so since this is average linkage, it's sort of based on calculating all pairs of similarities between each of these two and the elements of here, and then averaging all of those things. As I mentioned, there's a couple of other methods of this complete linkage and partial linkage. Measures of similarity are usually either this Euclidean distance, which is sort of an absolute measure or correlation. And so here, the Euclidean distance is small. These two profiles are, for all of these genes, if this is tumor one and this is tumor two, the values are pretty close to each other. But the differences, they don't sort of go in the same direction across the different genes. So here, the absolute expression levels are not the same, but sort of gene 2 is high here, gene 2 is high here. Gene 3 is low here, gene 3 is low here. So it's a funny notion of correlation, because it's, you're correlating expression levels of different genes. Usually when we talk about correlating, we're thinking of the same variable in different cases, but here it's all within one case and correlating different genes for two cases. But it is a measure that's sort of commonly used for clustering. And as I mentioned, when you switch anything, if you switch the correlation measure, or you switch the linkage measure, whether you gene center or don't gene center, you basically get a different cluster analysis. One point you can that is good to note is that when you see, if you probably never see something like this, but here, so this is 1 minus correlation. So this represents sort of a 90% correlation. So the idea is that when things get merged here, they're really very similar. And this cluster is very different from this cluster. So because when they get merged, it's up at a level of a relatively low correlation. So say the average similarity between any of these and any of these has a low correlation, but the average similarity between anything within this cluster is very high. So we have two very uniform, very distinct clusters. This is what you would love to see, at least if it told you something that you didn't already know, such that, well, these were all done in week one and these were all done in week two, and it's just a technical artifact. But if it tells you something biological, then this is what you'd like to see. This is what you often see. And things get merged very high up at the dendrogram, and the clusters themselves, and somebody reports, well, we found two clusters, and so we think that this disease is actually two diseases. Well, there's no way of making up a set of data that when you do hierarchical clustering, you won't get two clusters, because that's just the nature of it. There's, at the top level, you always get two clusters. So saying that there are two clusters is really a complete misinterpretation of the data. These are two very heterogeneous clusters. You know, these two things are pretty similar, but this is not very similar to these, and none of these are very similar to these, and so this is really not really very meaningful. And often what happens is you're not even provided with this scale, or the people who were doing it or who developed the program don't even realize that for interpreting the dendrogram into whether it's garbage or whether it's really meaningful, it's uninterpretable without the scale and without things being drawn to scale. And so what they do is they just sort of arbitrarily squash things and represent it as two clusters. And totally uninterpretable. So these are some of the problems with trying to... So cluster analysis is... the objectives can be very often used for when it shouldn't be used, and in cases where it should be used, it's still very difficult to interpret. I think I'm going to skip through. I mentioned this fallacy of clustering cases based on selecting genes already twice, so we don't need to go over that again. And there are different clustering algorithms. Self-organizing maps is really just a clustering algorithm. It's a clustering algorithm that sort of gives you sort of a continuous set it's useful for clustering genes, not for clustering samples. But if you have a, say, time course data, and you say, well, which genes are differentially expressed among these time variables, and you select the genes, you do some kind of an analysis, say, either with a correlation with a quantitative trait, the quantitative trait being time, or some kind of a class comparison, and you find the genes that are differentially expressed, and then you sort of want to sort those genes into groups based on what kind of patterns they show over time. Self-organizing map can be useful for that. We don't actually have the self-organizing map implemented in BRB array tools. You can use other sort of methods of clustering. So the idea is you do gene finding, you get the set of genes, and then when you do clustering in BRB array tools, you say, oh, I only want to cluster this gene set that I saved from this previous analysis. And I'll try to show you how you do that. But it would be nice at some point if we include the self-organizing map. There have been some studies of different clustering methods based on simulated data where you know what the true cluster structure is. And my problem is I have trouble reading these things because I'm sort of colorblind, but I think one thing it shows is that single linkage clustering is the thing at the bottom. And so I think they're calculating a z-score comparing things to the true model. And I think basically single linkage clustering did worse here. And actually, for this set of data, average linkage clustering, I think, is the one that did the second worst. And that was sort of a surprise to a lot of people, because most people think of average linkage clustering as a reasonable method. But complete linkage hierarchical clustering did actually much better than that. As I mentioned, clustering algorithms always find clusters, even when there is no real clustering in the data. And their BRB array tools does have a couple of tools in it, components in it, to try to get at whether the clustering is greater than what you would expect by chance. One is sort of a calculation of cluster significance, and the other is cluster reproducibility. And we've published on both of these sort of things, there's a paper on our website that I think Lisa McShane was the first author of, was published in Bioinformatics some years ago. Actually, it was Journal of Computational Biology, I believe. And basically what we do is you transform the expression data to principal component space and compute a median of the empirical distribution of distance of each sample from its nearest neighbor, and compute the distribution of of that statistic for data generated from multivariate Gaussian null distributions in principal component space and repeat that for these Gaussian, this Gaussian multivariate Gaussian distribution is a non-clustered distribution. So we're sort of comparing this test statistic we get for our actual data with the test statistics you would get from a model in which there was no real clustering. And the proportion of the null distribution replications, that the median of the nearest neighbor distances is as small as for our real data, gives us a p-value for clustering. Again, you don't wind up using that very often because most problems are not really clustering problems. And I think given the time, we won't go through the cluster reproducibility measure. We do have some measures of cluster reproducibility that are included in BRB array tools. Visualization tools are basically this kind of dendrogram I've showed you, or the dendrogram can be labeled and colored by columns of, you know, the things, and you can specify a column of your experiment descriptor worksheet. And the other very popular sort of way of summarizing the data is by having what's called this heat map, in which the columns of it represent the samples and the rows represent the genes, and you have sort of a color coding of the expression level of each gene in each sample. And you generally show this just for genes that have been selected as differentially expressed, and then to, as a way of showing if you have a bunch of different, say, diagnostic classes, of showing which genes they are, maybe with some labeling of the genes and for which samples they're high in or which samples they're low in. And it is a way of presenting a lot of data in a very concise manner. And BRB Array Tools has in its clustering methods this heat map option. Multidimensional scaling is sort of an interesting method. Some people call it principal components analysis. It's based on sort of how to most accurately represent the pairwise distance between expression profiles, sort of if you have sort of 5,000 genes, and you sort of want to represent which cases, which samples are similar to which other samples, with regard to, say, all of your genes, and you want to sort of represent that in the three dimensions. And so what you do is the multidimensional scaling gives you sort of 3D coordinates of these samples that best preserve the true, Euclidean distances among these samples that includes all of the genes. And I won't go through the details of the principal components, but I can show, maybe we will show you the an example of that, because it can be a useful thing. So we had this one column here in this Pomeroy data set. There are various different diagnoses, and there's this one column called diagnosis. And so if we go to, let's see, where is multidimensional? Here's multidimensional scaling of samples. And then we will show the rotating scatter plot. No, we will not compute a global test of clustering. We'll just use centered correlation as our similarity metric. We use all of the experiments. And the options, color the rotating scatter plot using diagnosis column. And click OK. And we have a sort of a Java application that does it. And you can, so each point represents a different sample, different one of those cases. And say we want to stop it here and say, well, gee, these blue things look like they're very different than, so the color coding is for the diagnoses because we told it to do it. So we want to say, well, what are those blue things? We can sort of, this is called brushing. And we see, well, these are the rhabdomyosarcomas, the ATRT cases. And you can rotate it in different directions to try to see what's actually separated. And if you rotate it right, you see, well, these yellow ones are sort of separated from most of the other ones too. What are they? They're the glios. And the massive red ones are the medulloblastomas. You can rotate it, you know, in other directions. And one nice thing about it is you can actually show this rotating plot in a PowerPoint presentation because actually it saves on your computer sort of the coordinates. And we have in the user's guide a very simple way of using that if you're running PowerPoint on your own computer, on the same computer that you're using for running BRB Array Tools. BRB Array Tools doesn't have to be running, but we show you how to set up your PowerPoint so that you can show the rotating multidimensional scaling plot, and you can even, it even gives you these controls, and so you can stop the rotation and do that in PowerPoint. Okay, so that can be sort of useful. You can also use it for just looking for sort of outliers, ones that just are very different than all of your other arrays that you might want to check as to whether there's a quality problem. Let's see. Did I do something to the PowerPoint? Let me just make sure that was the last thing I wanted to do here. I'm not sure. Oh, I know. Let me do this first. I just want to show you what the dialogue looks like for And we do have also the scatter plot tool, let me show you the dialogue for the clustering. With clustering, we have sort of two kinds of clustering set. Well, three. One, genes and samples, or just samples alone. We actually include Mike Eisen's cluster and tree view programs here. And so you don't have to export your data and then import it into cluster or tree view. We've sort of built a direct link and actually included those programs as part of BRB Array Tools. And tree view is sort of nice. And so, anyway, and we have our own sort of native clustering that has these reproducibility measures built into it. I guess the one other thing maybe is to just show something quickly about the scatter plot. Scatter plots can be sort of useful, either scatter plots of the expression levels on one array versus on the other array, or a quick way, it's not as good as class comparison, but a quick way of looking at one class versus another class is to say, well, let's average results for all of the I guess we would want to do the medullo males versus the medullo females. So let's do phenotype being the sex, and sex I think was only there for the medulloblastoma cases. And let's show the things that are twofold different on average between those two classes. And so you get this scatter plot. And this is the only thing we actually use Excel for. We're actually using an Excel-generated scatter plot. And so these are the females, and these are the males, and each point represents a different gene. And these lines represent twofold up or down. And so you do see some genes that are sort of out there. And if you want to know, well, what are they, then you can sort of click on those and find out. These are the probe set IDs, but if you click on them, I think it sort of should hyperlink to, well, unfortunately, it's taking us to NetAffix, which I think I'll just skip now. I think that's the one case where we have not included the info link, in which we already have imported those gene annotations. I think we'll basically, it's been a full day, and we'll stop and see if there are any questions. If not, you know, if you have any questions later, feel free to email me. And we do have a fairly active message board on the BRB Array Tools website, in which discusses various issues and problems people have too.
Okay, I have one question. You took us learning misconceptions in this area. And can you tell us if there are any other situations, similar situations in other fields?
Well, I don't think it's limited to gene expression profiling. I mean, I think similar kinds of things go on in proteomics, you know, in sort of serum proteomics using... I think the thing with expression profiling is it's a technology that a lot of people are using. And so it's an interesting question. I don't know of another example. I mean, I think the misconceptions and everything in a way is a sign of health. It's a sign of that there's a technology that is potentially really valuable very broadly to lots of kinds of studies, and people want to use it, and people don't have the background, and yet it leads to sort of the kinds of analysis issues of using it is required. You know, people are not prepared for trying to analyze the data from it, and so I think it's just a transition, and I think things are definitely getting better. I'm sorry if I sort of overemphasize the problems. I think things are definitely improving, and I think there are many very good studies of expression profiling published in the literature, and there are many very good statistical methods being developed for analyzing the data. And so I may have sort of overemphasized the negative, but you do see a lot of the negative, but you also do see a lot of very good use of it. So I think it's just a sign of a very vibrant field in which people are, it's in transition with people educating themselves as to how to use the technology effectively and how to, and for sort of interdisciplinary links being made. There's such a wide use of the technology that there's really not enough statisticians certainly involved who are really available, even in my group, to really handle the degree of collaboration and consultation that would be warranted. And so, I think there really is an educational process that has to go through. But I think, unfortunately, because of the amount of misinformation out there, it makes the educational process is made more difficult.
Yeah. Any other questions?
Dr. Simon, I have a question about crass prediction. So, as far as I know, most of these clinical trials for cancer detection use sensitivity and specificity and ROC curve as the primary measures for accuracy, and most of the statistical methods were also developed on that. But during today's workshop, I was just wondering, because the prediction values seem to be more relevant to the notion of class prediction. So I'm wondering, would they be more appropriate measures for such micro-risk studies, data sensitivity and specificity?
No, I think I think it would probably be an improvement. I mean, one could. Where we sort of generate these cross-validated predictive accuracies, it probably would give would be better if we could also generate cross-validated sensitivities and specificities and ROC curves. So in other words, I didn't actually even mention how we have a prediction threshold, but say for these linear classifiers. Say you leave one case out, and then for your training set, you develop some kind of a linear classifier, and or a linear, say linear diagonal linear discriminant analysis. And so then you have what you do is you say, well, the cases that are class one in the training set, what is the average for those with regard to this linear function, and the ones that are class 2 in the training set, what's the average of those for the linear discriminant? And you actually, we generally use just the midpoint of those two things as sort of the detection threshold. And then use that for classifying the one that was left out. But you could actually try to do that for a grid of values of detection thresholds. And then you would get a range of predictions for the one that was left out, one prediction for each element of your grid of detection thresholds. And when you put all of that together, what you'd have would be, as your detection threshold change, you'd have your, essentially your sensitivity and specificity would change. So you actually could generate, at least for the linear classifiers, a cross-validated ROC curve. And I don't know whether there would, I think that would probably work. It might be on what scale you let the detection threshold change. There might be some issue you have to deal with there. But I think that basically would work, and I think we haven't done that just because it was easier to look at, to just pick a single detection threshold. But I think you're right. I think there is really no reason to believe that predictive accuracy rather than sensitivity and specificity should be the right thing. And because for any particular problem, how you weight the different types of errors may be very different. And so a false positive may be very more costly or less costly than a false negative. And by generating a cross-validated ROC curve, it would be a richer way of looking at it.
I understand the importance of internal validation, as you emphasized in your talk, especially when n is less than p. But I would like to know your viewpoint about the difference between internal validation and goodness of fit when n is actually larger than p.
Okay, when the number of cases is larger than the number of ordinary. And the relative importance of goodness of fit versus
internal validation, like cross validation.
Oh, okay. Well, you know, we've had, you know, in statistics, these we've always tried to have rules of thumb of how many, you know, some people's rules of thumb is you should have 10 cases per variable for sort of model development. And as far as I can tell, I've never been able to find a real good basis for any of those rules of thumb. And I think that, and I'm not sure even the concept of what they assure. And so it may be for assuring that you have a stable model in the sense that you really can, that if you had different data, you'd get this, and you'd develop a model, you'd get the same model. I don't think it's, I think for most statistical problems, many statistical problems are not prediction problems. And a lot of them are really trying to understand what's going on. And in which case, and so when you say, when we say, well, we want model stability, it means we really want to know what's going on. We want to know, are things linear, are things not linear, what's interacting with what. And for that objective, model stability is I think, is probably the right, you know, a reasonable criterion. And so I think that's part of the reason why we don't use cross-validation, is because cross-validation is mostly really just for estimating predictive accuracy. There was a paper, I think about a year ago or within the last year, claiming that for microarrays, you need to have at least thousands of arrays to have a reasonable sample size. And if you really look at the paper, it was by people who didn't have much involvement with actual biomedical studies, and it really was for purposes of model stability, and model stability is not really, I don't think, shouldn't really be the objective, you know, when you're talking about predictive models to be used in some medical context. So, I think just, you know, there's it's like anything. I think that the most important part of any problem is being very clear as to what the real objective is.
Any other questions? If there's no question, let's thank Dr. Simon again for this wonderful workshop.
这个？
那不是，我们说的这台是我们的，那个是他的。
时钟他还给郝小姐。是的啦。你干嘛贴啊？是的，干嘛贴啊？我给他看。
这是阮内底人念的嘛？
对啊，恁内底人念。
当然知道了，这款的。无开的啦。
好啊，那唔好。
稍等一下，伊手咧贴，伊要迄个要砸东西。
你这样真对。
啊，无多对，
十几对。
十对啊。
因遐收七台，
啊，内底阁有啦，内底阁有啊，我无拢摕出来，
再上台了，
我无当时
间。家己迄录音的笔记本电脑收的，
用怕。
等你拍，你再去打。
更加无啦，那内底台湾尔，出一个两个资料了，当坏完了。他收的资料，我真刚差等于美国啊。现在心理操纵不用花钱哦。感谢陈小姐，这依然的。不要收的，图书馆我不要收，我就跟他开除。
开除，
跟你校长。
你无公安无注意，
直接开除跟你校长沟通。哎、欸，我同学跟你五年不会开机的。
骗人！
真的。
他不会开机，他上课在干嘛？
去聊天啊。
哎，我看一看，我看多了。
会坏掉。哦。你买几样的？哎，看这里能贴。这是要冲啊！你坐来坐顶领导啦，你讲你来做这个会议的。
你个广告开几遍哦？哎呀，王家真系唔知。
哎呀，你做爱啊？你是
做爱？
哎，应该是你嘛？
做顺的啊！
你可以去换那支咯。
好了，这放着不用收了。哎，那瓶水，哎，那个，啊，算了，你的水要给谁哦？哎，这其实够再够用对不？刀刀片涂的对，够再用对。
刀片涂你涂还好，提光色啊嘛。
啊，穿无看到你色的。
见见，人第二场会场布啊，见见。你讲用对吧？再来给我苦逼的，苦逼完我算了。嗯，再
最后那个架子就好了。
没有，我们要对对它的屏幕的高度，要起底。
Mm-hmm.